Four, three, two, one. You are listening to Punky's Podcast. I don't know, 620, 621, 622. It's been a crazy December, but you were here with two very positive people that are always positive and never are angry. They're always just say hooray for life.
Hooray for life.
It's me and Hallie Bullitt on the duo attack today. Hallie Bullitt, are you ready for our duo attack? Which on honestly, I do love the three panel, even the four panel podcast. Three panel is probably my preferred. But I gotta say, the duo one-on-one, I do enjoy the duo one-on-one.
I like it too. It feels chill.
Actually, and before we even get started, I gotta talk about something inconsequential. We were talking about Men Without Hats. I finally got my Men Without Hats remastered CD in the mail. Hallie, I love Men Without Hats now. Hallie, in the last 2 days, how many times do you think I listened to the Safety Dance?
Oh, I don't know, like 12.
15 times. And yes. There's four versions of the Safety Dance. Like, there's the club mix and the stereo, the radio mix. And, man, I love the Safety Dance, Hallie. I love the Safety Dance.
It is an undeniably, it's a great song. It's also, for as much of it has so many of the qualities that, 80s pop and new wave had. But, I also just sort of feel like there's just nothing that sounds like that song, right?
Actually, I was thinking about that exact issue, and Punk News Podcast, welcome to where we discuss the Safety Dance. what if Devo sang the Safety Dance? I think people would say I think it would have been a gigantic Devo hit if Devo.
I agree with you. But it would have been slightly right if Devo plays it. It's a little edgier. But I agree with you. It would make a smashing Devo song, and I would love to hear them cover it.
What I also like about the Safety Dance, and I'll shut up about the – I'm thrilled because – and actually, we'll talk about this in a second, and then we'll get to some mail. But I will say is – where is it going with this is – oh, what I like about the Safety Dance is the song's called the Safety Dance, and, the refrain is S-A-F-T-E-Y, dance, do-do-do. But then they don't talk about safety in the song at all, so it's completely, arbitrary. The song is about, how – we're in the gang where we dress cool. And it's called the Safety Dance. You know what I mean?
You also just misspelled safety.
S-A-F-E-T-Y?
Yeah.
The Safety Dance. Hallie, related to that is, when you're, 15 to 25, maybe once a month, maybe once every other month, you hear something that just completely cracks your skull open. And you're like, I've never heard anything like this before. My mind is blown. And the older you get, the rarer and rarer it happens because you're like, oh, it's a reggae song or, oh, it's hardcore or, oh, it's a new take on hardcore, but it's still hardcore. What's the last thing that really blew your mind?
Oh, I love that point that you made. You're right. Honestly, I don't know. Is it corny to say it was that new Paramore song?
That blew your mind? Really?
It kind of did. Is that a weak answer? I really loved that. Maybe it was because it was so, maybe because it was that particular song was unexpected to me from Paramore. So let me see if I take that element out of it, would I be, if that had just been a new band that I'd never heard before, I would have been like, wow, I like this band, but I probably wouldn't have felt like my mind was blown by it.
If your mind was blown, your mind was blown. You don't need to.
It kind of was. I don't know. I thought that song was really cool. I don't know. Maybe I'm too easily blown away, but I liked it.
Well, there you have it. Hallie
Bowe. But what about for you? What was the last thing that blew you away?
Anymore, I'm lucky if I get blown away once a year, which even at that rate, I'm pretty thrilled with, to tell you the truth. I will say a couple of years, Surfboard really blew my mind. Not because they sound super unique, but it's just so good. And it is a little unique, Mm-hmm. And actually, the second record actually kind of blew me away because I thought it was going to suck. And I didn't love it at first. And then it just clicked and I absolutely love it. But I will say, I was kind of blown away by Men Without Hats just because it's such a good record, the whole record all the way through. But I would say before that, probably actually I was kind of blown away by Froggy. Like their album, even though it's not super unique, it's just so good, the new Froggy album. But I'll say the last unique thing is New Age Steppers, and that kind of blew me away because I've had the first New Age Steppers CD for about 10 years or 5 years, like 10 years. And I listened to it, and the first one is extremely experimental, and I'd never listened to the second, third, and fourth. And then I heard it, and it is like this space age reggae with Ari Up singing or Horace Andy or somebody. Oh, I got the best answer, but well, not the best answer. I got a good answer. Anyway, so the New Age Stepper box set blew my mind away because I'm a huge Slits fan. And then here comes basically the sequel to the Slits that I had written off before as being too experimental. And now it doesn't even feel that experimental to me. And it's just so good and so different and so unique. And Aria, it's as good as the Slits. And that's one of my favorite bands of all time. So that blew me away. Along those lines, and then I'll shut up, is the new Horace Andy album, Midnight Rockers, which is basically Horace Andy singing over top New Age Steppers type sounds. Adrian Sherwood. So good. So good. So yeah, mm-hmm. so that's what blew me away. So listen. See,
there's stuff that still gets you.
Oh, definitely. I mean, honestly, that's the fun thing about music is there's always something new to find. And you might not get blown away as much as you used to when you were like when I was 15, I heard Alice Cooper, blown away. You hear AC/DC, blown away. Hear the Beastie Boys, blown away. You know, and so you don't get that spark as much. But when you do get it, it's great. It's like heroin. You know, the first time is terrible. The second time is great. And then you spend your life chasing that high. And then once in a while, you get it, you know.
Totally.
Don't do heroin, kids. It's bad for you. But do... Write us at podcast@punknews.org. And this is Daniel Leary. He's written in before. Not that Daniel Leary. A different Daniel Leary. Maybe it is that. Actually, I don't know that it's not that Daniel Leary. Maybe it is. The title of his email is Jerry Lee Lewis. Because when Jerry Lee Lewis passed away, we were talking about what do we do when a great musician is kind of a rotten guy all around. And I believe, and Hallie, don't let me put words in your mouth. Hallie was like, well, he's a rotten guy, so I don't really care. And that was about M. Moore's response too. Where I was like, well, he's a rotten guy, but he changed music, so I don't know what to do with it, you know? Whereas if he wasn't so rotten, like if he just did like a Jimmy Page, I'd be like, nah, man, he's cool, you know? You know? So anyways, here's what Dan had to say. And actually, we actually had a little bit of a friendly email exchange, so I'm going to combine two of his emails together in reading this. It's hard to listen to your podcast opinions on Jerry Lee Lewis. It's hard to listen to your on Jerry Lee Lewis and similar men and whether such problematic figures should be canceled when you still all hold Tim Armstrong in such high regard. And let me point out, listener, this is Daniel talking, not me. Every time you discuss the possibility of an Operation Ivy reunion, I cringe thinking about how much esteem is placed in a man who groomed a 16-year-old, mentally abused her, gaslit her when she wanted to leave him, and then stood by complicit when his legions of fans continued to harass her and her new family for years afterwards. And then I said, for my own edification, are you referring to something specifically with Tim Armstrong? And Dan said, I appreciate your reply. I got roped into talking online with strangers about this a few times a year, and I don't get why Tim Armstrong's actions are either ignored or outright defended when I don't see them as separate from similar actions by other celebrities who have been openly criticized. But I forget this really hasn't had that much exposure. The interview with Brody Dahl is one of the major moments she spoke out about the treatment by Tim Armstrong and his camp after the divorce. It then links to an interview from The Guardian from April 2014. It includes the blacklisting and dealing with accusation and harassment from fans and those in the punk scene close to Armstrong that she's nothing but a gold digger who just used him for her fame. All while, I'm adding this here, she was 16 to 24 years old across the relationship. He was in his 30s when they started dating and she was 16 and he married her at 18. I love the music of Rancid and Tim Armstrong's other works for so long, but I was equally a fan of Brody Dahl at the time of their divorce, and I'm only a few years younger than her, so I didn't take a side in the split. But that also means I did not consider at the time just how alarming the facts of the relationship were until the current discourse about it online and adding the hindsight context that I'm now older. And furthermore, these online discussions may not count as sources, but they also made me open my eyes to this matter. I've heard most of the counterpoints on it. They don't work for me. Is 16 the age of consent in some places? Sure, but not in California where Armstrong is or was a legal resident. And furthermore, that age of consent point does not hold water in most discussions about powerful celebrities dating teens, such as Jimmy Page and Jerry Lee Lewis. And the idea that a 16, 18-year-old girl is painted in the corners of a punk community as having agency and to some, the deceitful cunning to entice Armstrong with a relationship just shows she could boost her position in one subgenre of the scene is so outlandish. He was the one with the fame and the success to obtain what he wanted, and that is the abuse of power that always gets discussed in the recent climate. But strangely, I don't see it extending to Armstrong. And I told Daniel I would read his letter, and I did. I'm not super familiar with the Tim Armstrong thing. I've heard rumors about it here and there. So I mean, Hallie, I don't know if you've got a response or I can just give a general response. I don't know.
No, I mean, I first of all, I should just say, like, right off the bat that this is just the first I'm hearing of any of this, because I'm not a huge Tim Armstrong fan. You know, like, as him as a person, like, I find him to be kind of a dummy when I like read interviews with him and stuff. So I didn't know. I mean, I'm glad that people can write in and, like you said, just sort of like share information. I like that it's done in like such a thoughtful way, right? Like, I like that this letter is just so, it's like, it's so thoughtful and just like, this is the information I have. This is what I think. I mean, I can't say I don't know what the word is to use, because I can't be like, I'm happy to know it, but like, I, you know, it makes me sad to hear that. But I'm better off for knowing, you know, what I can, I would have to look into this myself, but I believe victims. If she's out there saying that she was victimized, I would tend to believe her. So I don't ever get too caught up in the like, well, where's your proof? Like, I don't know. I'm obviously just tripping over my words a little bit. I think that's more that I'm tired than, that I feel uncomfortable talking about the subject matter. I feel totally comfortable talking about it. And I guess, yeah, just in summary, I didn't know this. And I appreciate that I appreciate that he wrote in, and I appreciate that you took the time to read the letter. I think this stuff is important. You know, I think it's important for us to all just be talking about this stuff.
I will say, I mean, I don't know a whole lot of the Tim Armstrong thing. I've been meaning to look into it for a couple of years, but I mean, it is tough to come to a conclusion on that, because I mean, I know from writing, you know, a book, is a lot of things people believe isn't true, you know, and people only know like 1/10 of the story. You know what I mean? But you know, sometimes things are so clear, it's clear, you know. I don't know a whole lot about the Tim Armstrong thing. I've been meaning to dig. I just haven't really dug into it, honestly, because I like Rancid, but I'm not. I don't think we fan over Rancid on the podcast. In fact, I think we kind of smack on him too much, this current issue excluded, you know. I mean, it's a good point, but I will say, underscores the point, is people often, you know, this issue is they will focus on bad actors when they don't particularly like the bad actor, if they want to get the bad actor. But if it's someone they like, oh, that person tends to get a free pass when they probably shouldn't, you know. And it further, you know, extends the discussion of what do you do when your favorite artist is kind of a creep or a jerk. And also, I mean, you know, my rule is, well, if they're just kind of a jerk, then you can let it slide. But if they're a real creep, like a racist or something, then I mean, a real creep like a racist or a rapist or something. Well, that's kind of tough. You know, it's tough to listen to someone that's truly bad. You know, I can listen to a jerk. You know, I wrote books about one. But, it's tough to, if someone's genuinely a bad guy, like a real bad guy, you know, and that also goes to Chuck, like, and then there's not one solid answer, and I don't know if we can come to a solid answer. Like Chuck Berry, man, he took video of women going to the bathroom. That's pretty creepy, you know. That's pretty real creepy. So should we not listen to Chuck Berry? That's a tough question, you know. But
it's like, all really tough. And oh, sorry, go ahead.
Look, Bill Cosby, one of the worst guys there is. I had no problem. I used to love the Cosby Show. I don't want to watch the Cosby Show at all now. You know what I mean? So it appears to me there is some internal line, but maybe that's because I like Chuck Berry more than the Cosby Show. But then again, even though Chuck Berry was creepy, I would say most people would agree that what Bill Cosby did was a lot worse than what Chuck Berry did, you know.
But I think what you hit upon is like exactly it. It's like, you know, for each artist and listener, where is that line for you? And I think you hit upon it. It's like you do get to a point with certain artists where you're just like, what I know about this person means that that I can no longer enjoy their art. I'm not trying to cancel them. I'm not going out of my way to make some big statement. It's just that for me personally, what I know about this person makes it so that when I watch their movies or I listen to their songs, I just don't get the same pleasure out of it that I used to. And it sounds like, you know, I don't know why my short-term memory is so bad. The guy who wrote the letter is Daniel. Is that right?
Daniel Leary, famous LSD experimenter.
Daniel.
That's Timothy Leary.
Daniel is like also saying that for him, like that he was a big fan and that this is like not, you know, that he had to let go of something that meant something to him because he was so disturbed by everything that he heard. I will say, I wonder if there's not something to be said though for, I think for me personally, again, just when we're talking about when do you reach that personal tipping point, I am finding right now, just looking inside my own heart, that there is a little bit of a difference for me with someone who was like us, like just them making the music, right? Like you're talking about, like, Lewis is like, that's just like, it's just him. Whereas like you're talking about Op Ivy is a group of musicians. And now we're talking about like, if I have a problem with one of the members of that band, now how do I feel about the whole band? Because obviously that has other people in it that didn't do anything wrong. And so that makes it more complicated for me. You know what I mean? Like, but I don't know. Yeah. I'm glad that people feel like they can just write in about the stuff, and that I think what they hope, I hope what they know is that, you know, we're always happy to have this discourse opened up. You know what I mean?
Indeed. And not to drag it out, but I'm going to add another thing in there though. And I'll just use Bill Cosby as an extreme example, or Mel Gibson as an extreme example. You know, both total creeps. I'm not going to watch their stuff. You know what I mean?
No.
Or even Tom Cruise. But on the other hand is though, like, especially in the punk community, people, like, if the artist doesn't agree with every single thing you agree with, they cut them out. I don't think you can go that far either. You know what I mean? So.
But you can, if that's how you are. Do you know what I mean? If that's how you feel.
I would argue that's damaging to your own intellect, or limiting to your own intellect, honestly. Anyways, there's no answer, sadly, until Q.
No, and I don't think anyone's asking us to answer any of anything. You know, I think it's just I think more than anything, it's just like the letter is just a way, and sending it to us and having us talk about it on the air is a way to get this information out to more people so that they have it. You know what I mean?
Indeed. So let's cap this off. I'm gonna play a song. This is a pretty cool track. This is a Bauhaus. Hallie, are you a Bauhaus fan?
Mm-hmm.
I love Bauhaus. And Bauhaus's fourth album, Burning from the Inside. Some days that's my favorite. Some days the first album's my favorite. But anyways, little did people know that between the time that Bauhaus recorded their last album, and they broke up for the first time of three times, I think, they recorded a track called Antarctica. And this is like an unreleased Bauhaus track, like, is that like 85, I guess, called Antarctica. And we'll be right back.
Reflection, the beaches and the past.
Versace. That wasn't Bauhaus. That was Men Without Hats doing a song called Antarctica. That sounds like Bauhaus. Take that, listener. Take that. They didn't see that one coming, did they, Hallie?
It's times like this that I really wish that we listened, because maybe the listeners don't know. We don't personally sit around and like listen to the music that you're later gonna drop into the episode, but right now I wish I were listening to that song.
there are so many. I actually am astounded at how many one-hit wonder 80s bands actually have like at least one incredibly killer album, and I am astounded how some of those bands have one track that sounds exactly like Bauhaus. There's a track by Flock of Seagulls called Standing in the Doorway, which sounds exactly like Bauhaus. No, I'm sorry, the track is Standing in the Doorway is like a punk song. The Flock of Seagulls song is Messages. It sounds exactly like Bauhaus. And the Men Without Hats song, Antarctica, sounds exactly like Bauhaus. 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 Anyways, speaking of dark and spooky things, Gizem, the Japanese icons. Oh, Hallie, this is going to continue our previous discussion. I'm going to try to not drag it out too much. But anyway, Gizem, depending on how you pronounce it, I've been told by Japanese people, well, actually, people from Japan that I've spoken to have pronounced it Gizem, Jizem, and Gizem. I've been told by people that are not Japanese that know everything about punk rock, Colin of Sit and Spin Records, who knows everything about punk rock-wise, I mean that in a positive sense, he says Jizem. However, Dwed Hellion of Integrity, who knows the guys, says Gizem. Although I suspect he says Gizem, because frankly, Jizem is a pretty cheesy name. But Gizem sounds cooler. But however you pronounce it, they are re-releasing their second album on Relapse. Last year, their first album was released on Relapse to the surprise of everybody, because it was released in Japan in 1984, I think. And then every issue after that was pretty much bootleg, and it had never been released outside of Japan. And I think people, myself included, just assumed that this release will never get released outside of Japan, because the singer is kind of a really weird guy and he doesn't want to repress it. And then lo and behold, last year, Relapse re-released the first record. Surprisingly to me, despite the fact that you see Gizem shirts and patches on every Uber Punk, anytime you go to an Uber Punk show, you're going to see three Gizem patches. It kind of didn't blow. I thought it was going to blow up the world and everyone would be like, Gizem's back, no one cared. I mean, like, they sold some records, but there wasn't like any big interviews. I think I'm the only guy that did like a review, honestly, or maybe some other people that review. There weren't that many reviews. And we're going to talk about kind of a sticky subject after we talk about this right here. Anyways, yet again, I find myself surprised that they are re-releasing the second less heralded album, but honestly pretty good, Military's Affair Neurotic by Gizem. Military Affairs Neurotic is probably less schizophrenic and less crazy than the first record, but it's kind of darker and heavier and I guess maybe more consistent. Although also maybe more samey. Of course, the cover features Cherry Nishida's Wild and Wet. No, I'm sorry, not Cherry Nishida. Sakivi, the singer, his crazy art, and he still makes crazy T-shirts. At any rate, I was pleasantly surprised by this, and I ordered it right away. Yet again, it did not blow up the internet like I thought any Gizem thing would, which just goes to show, Hallie Bullet says to me, she says, people don't fake liking a band. They genuinely like a band. But I disagree, because the number of Gizem or Gizem patches I see, this should be as big as Taylor Swift, yet it kind of came and went with a whimper. Hallie Blue, what do you think of Gizem or Gizem or Gizem? And were you surprised that this had not a explosive announcement?
No, this is where I'm going to let you down, that this is just the two of us on this episode, because I have literally no opinion about this band. I don't care. You need M. Moore here to talk about this band with you. I don't care.
I think this might be a little bit too old school for M, although M is surprising sometimes. M's got a very deep musical knowledge. Here, and Hallie, I don't want to pin you against the wall, so feel free to not answer or a lot of people get kind of iffy about talking about this topic, Relapse included. So Gizem's first album, Detestation, has a swastika on the cover. Now, simply having a swastika on the cover doesn't mean somebody's Nazi. There's lots of Jewish bands that have swastikas on the cover. Buzz Osborne's half Jewish. He put a swastika on one side of a Melvins record, and he put a cross on the other side. And the idea was symbols of power. So anyways, you can say that's in poor taste or not. Doesn't mean that Gizem are racist or Nazis or whatever. Also importantly, they're from Japan. And Japan, of course, in World War II, were on the other side. Also importantly, depending on where you go, the swastika has different meanings. In America, I think people see the swastika and they think Nazis or racism. wherein, as we've discussed before, in the UK, while it also has those connotations, it also has the connotation of the people that bombed our houses, you see. So it's not it's a slightly different take. I don't know what the general vibe of the swastika is in Japan. However, here's where it gets even trickier, though. So you could say, well, you know, what exactly is Sakive mean by that? We're not sure. However, when he kind of reworked the Detestation album in 2015 as Determination, and this is me quoting the album, this is not me speaking, this is me quoting the cover of the album. The cover of the album has a bunch of like Al-Qaeda type imagery and dead people and crazy things all over the cover. And then it has at the bottom, and this is me quoting the album, this is not me saying this, privately owned international Jew banks finance both sides in a war, making a killing from military spending. So that's kind of damning, you know. But you could say, well, he doesn't actually mean that. That's collision art. I don't know. And the fact of the matter is, it is never that question has never been answered. Giesem has never really been taken to task one way or another for that. When Relapse reissued Detestation last year or the year before last year, whatever year, 2020, they included an obi strip. An obi strip is the strip that are on Japanese releases to designate them as Japanese releases. It's kind of like a little paper strip that goes all around the side of an album. They glued it over the cover of the album so you could not see the swastika. So which leads me to say is, if the swastika doesn't have a bad intent on the album cover, why cover it up, you see? So, Hallie, I don't know if you've got a perspective on that at all or not.
We talked about this before years ago on the podcast. I don't remember why it was coming up. I mean, I think it's, I don't know. I think it's thoughtless. I don't care enough about this band to like, I'm not going to dive too deep trying to figure out what do they mean by it. It's just, to me, it's like a symbol you put on a thing that's like, it's gonna, I don't know. It's really gonna seriously fucking upset a lot of people for good reason. I don't see why you'd do it. I just don't see why you would. I will say, like, I did travel to Taiwan like a bunch of years back. It was like one of the fucking most insanely amazing trips of my life. If anyone has a chance to go to Taiwan, it is absolutely awesome. What an awesome place. But we, you know, we ended up in this national park and there were swastikas everywhere because it was like the old, you know, Buddhist meaning, right? Buddhist. I hope I don't sound just totally uneducated right now. It was years ago that I was there, but I'm pretty sure it's like an old Buddhist symbol, right, John?
Well, yeah, I mean, the swastika in of itself goes back to prehistory. There's Roman swastikas, there's Greek swastikas, there's Indian swastikas, there's Asian swastikas. All, I mean, when you think about it, the design itself is not that creative. It's a pretty simple design.
It
probably evolved differently among different cultures. The Nazis appropriated its meaning and then gave it a different meaning than it had prior to Nazism.
Yeah. But like, you know, it was so upsetting to see it everywhere. We're in this like absolutely beautiful national park and I'm looking at it and I'm knowing that all of these swastikas were put up before World War II and that I know that that's not what it's implying, but it's like, you can't see it and think anything else. And like, especially now with just a global rise in anti-Semitism, fuck these people. They're not Jewish. They don't know what it feels like to have a symbol that just represents people wanting to annihilate you. And I'm not interested in like what fucking art statement they're trying to make. Maybe that's limited of me, but I can't humor this shit. I don't find it. It's not cute to me. Don't fucking put that shit on your artwork. You know, it bums me out, you know?
I will disagree with Hallie to some degree in that I do not think that the swastika should never be used in art. I think sometimes art should be upsetting, and a useful tool of art is to be upsetting. Yeah. I don't think a swastika should ever be used as a, hey, isn't this cool? Or even in the Slayer context where they like, even though one member of Slayer is Jewish and two are Hispanic, is it like Slayer used to appropriate Nazi imagery and like warp it to their own? Like maybe that's not cool. You know what I mean? But on the other hand, a lot of Nazi imagery is actually Roman imagery, you know? So it gets sticky. The point being is, I do think the swastika can be used in art if it's done carefully and with a specific purpose And as long as it's not, hey, isn't this cool? Because it's not. With Relapse, I just wish Relapse would take it head on. And you know, Sakivi could be like, yeah, I was 16. It was stupid. You know what I mean? And then everyone was like, all right, well, you were 16 and you know, you don't feel that way. You know what I mean? I will say Relapse takes a very high and mighty stance when it comes to racism. And other things like when Rob Miller went insane and they were like, well, Rob Miller's a bad guy, blah, blah. And then maybe the right stance to take. But then how come we're not doing that with Gizem? Is it because Gizem is worth more money? You know, I really just wish that they would take it head on and say, well, you know, it's collision art and he doesn't mean it as a racist context. He means look at how bad this is. Or he was 16 and he was, you know, stupid. Or he's literally schizophrenic and he can't help what he's saying, which to me is somewhat of a response. Or he's racist and you should know that he's racist before you buy it, you know. Yeah. And the fact that they're not taking it head on, I think, you know, speaks poorly of them. And the fact of the matter is the maximum rock and roll type punk fan loves Gizem. And they love hating racism or beating up racism. And they all just turn a blind eye to this issue because they love Gizem that much, which goes back to the discussion we were having. So there's a very big double standard in punk rock with regard to this issue and this philosophy in general. I'm a Gizem fan. I just wish I knew the answer to the question that is still outstanding, you know. And I think maybe deep down people do know the answer. And that's why they don't dig in. You know what I mean?
Yes. I think you're on to something there.
Well, let's do the exact opposite of worrisome and troublesome art. Jesse Michaels has got a new band. And on Instagram, he did a pretty cool thing where he basically did short little rundowns of the 10 bands that he's been in. And people are like, 10 bands? I thought he's been in 4. He actually forgot one, so technically it's 11. But a lot of people don't know is he was in like a bunch of bands before Op Ivy, a metal band, a punk band, and some other bands. He forgot to list Passage Walkers, a band that existed for 3 shows, and I saw all 3 shows. It was Jesse Michaels, a guy called like Philip Jean or something like that, and Ralph Spite from Jello's band, and they did kind of like Roger Miller, Johnny Cash stuff, and it was pretty cool, and I saw all 3 shows, and I'm special because I'm probably the only person that saw all 3 shows. But he's got a brand new band. He also, the new band, he said, is they're writing stuff. They're probably going to do live shows in 2023. And also that the World of Burning Hate, and actually also did something else that was interesting. So, of course, everyone knows Classics of Love was Jesse's big comeback band, and it was amazing. Then a couple of years ago, he put out World of Burning Hate, and that was Classics of Love, except it was an entirely different band. Jesse clarified that Classics of Love 1 and Classics of Love 2 are 2 entirely different bands with the same name, which I would say is an interesting, minute, but maybe important distinction. And he said, so that record's going to come out. A lot of people online were like, John, you're an idiot. This isn't news. He talked about that Classics of Love Mark II is putting out new stuff. But they are wrong. And I didn't want to argue with him online. But the new band is not the same band as Classics of Love Mark II. So Jesse's got a new band coming out. And I really hope it's just him doing hardcore again. Because for whatever reason, Jesse Michaels doing straight up hardcore is amazing. And if you ask me, maybe better than Operation Ivy. If anything, more mature than Operation Ivy. And I'm not just saying Operation Ivy because I love Operation Ivy, but it's definitely the voice of an 18-year-old, whereas Classic of Love is timeless. And I just thought World of Burning Hate and the Classic of Love album were stellar. I'm psyched for this. I hope it's not one of these Jesse Michaels flashes where it's going to come and then it never comes.
Yeah. I love that he did the like rundown of each of his projects. I thought that was cool. I do think it's interesting to say like it was a totally different band with the same name. That strikes me as so weird. It strikes me as almost like, I don't know, like why would you keep the same name if it's a totally different band? I mean, I guess he can do what he wants. That struck me as a little bit like, are you trying to rewrite history or like, I don't know. But how did that strike you, John?
I actually thought it was cool. When he did World of Burning Hate, he said, I've asked the other 3 members of the Hard Girls. I will say it's frustrating for me that Classic of Love stopped doing stuff. I guess it's because Jesse moved down to L.A. And so the other 3 guys were in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And I guess they would have rather done Hard Girls, which, listen, our Hard Girls is a fine band. But listen, if you're in a band with Jesse, Michael, say, Jesse, we're coming down to record some shit. And you can't say no. Unless maybe he said no. But the band was so good. Anyway, I'm getting off track here. Anyways. when he first did the World of Burning Hate EP, he said, I asked the Hard Girls if I can still use the name, and they said yes. I think he regrets that because I think he feels some loyalty to them and feels as though maybe that was the wrong call. He also mentioned that coming up with new band names is hard, which is true, and it's particularly hard when the name Classics of Love is such an incredible name within the context of that band. It's a smashing, violent, negative band, and it's called Classics of Love. You know, perfect name, you know. So there's poetry to it. You know, it's not like a lot of hardcore bands have, like, you know, like, Impaled, you know, Impaled Peace,
yeah,
or not even Impaled, like Impaled Violence, or like Death Chain, you know, or you know, Toxic Sewage, you know, it's like Classics of Love, but it's like the hardest thing ever. Not the hardest thing ever, but it's super hard, you yeah. know. So I think he just couldn't come up with a name, so he wanted to reuse that name. And maybe in the back of the mind, he thought, well, maybe I can keep some of the buzz from Classics of Love Mark One, which he did. It worked. I do think that EP got a little bit more buzz because it had the name Classics of Love, which is I'm fine with. But I also think it's wonderfully Jesse Michael, as you say, oh, it's two bands with the same name.
Yeah.
Hallie, but what do you think of Jesse Michaels on Instagram frequently commenting on how he's a failure in music and he wants to quit, but he can't because he's so connected to it? What do you think of the fact that Jesse Michaels feels as though he's a failure? Jesse Michaels feels he's a failure. And why?
I mean, I could see if you can't reproduce the success that you had as a very young person. I just can't. That would be so hard, you know? Especially when you feel like you're growing as an artist and you feel like you're improving at your craft and just you can't grab people in quite the same way, or not the same number of people. Obviously you're obviously you love Classics of Love and there are so many people that do, but I find it upsetting to hear that people that I admire like have feelings of failure, but obviously it's also, you know, it's, you know, we all have that to some degree or another. So, you know, I think people find some comfort in reading that kind of stuff online. Oh, like, look, oh, my hero, like also, you know, feels failure, feels disappointment. But you know, there's part of me that just like when someone's my hero, like I don't totally want to, like, I don't want to read their diary. Like, I don't want to hear that they feel like a failure. But I appreciate when people are willing to like share that part of themselves on social. I appreciate it even if it's not always information that I like really want or like wish I was privy to. I don't know, like you're an even bigger fan than I am. Like, how do you react to that when you're reading that online?
I use the same cheesy question in a lot of interviews that we do. I mean to pull back from it. I like, you know, if I like with Mean Jeans, he's like, you know, we're not that good, or we're. I'm like, do you wake up every morning saying like you're in the Mean Jeans, you're gonna kick ass and destroy the world? And he's like, I don't feel that way. I'm like, how can you not feel that way? You're in Mean Jeans, you know? Like I'm like, everyone should be like Black Dahlia. I'm the best. I'm James Brown. I'm KRS-One. I'm the best. Everyone should feel that way. Strangely, with Jesse Michaels, it doesn't bother me that he doesn't say that. And I think maybe because it comes off as very genuine from him, because he's a very unique, and frankly, I mean, he's a lyrical genius. I really do feel that way. I think artistically he excels at the highest level there is, if you can quantify art, which he would say you can't, but I'm saying you can. I would say I find that interesting that he feels that way. And I also want to, like, you know, send him on Twitter, like, Jesse, you're not a failure. You're the best. But he's already heard that a million times. And so it's almost more damaging to say that. You know what I mean? Because even though he has people showering him with praise, he still feels like a failure. So if you give it to him, it's like the cheesiest thing ever. The question is, and you know, people say, oh, you know, Jesse's psyche, it's you know, the tragic artist. The tragic artist that is the greatest there is, but feels like a failure. What beauty is there in that tragedy? The question is that really a defining part of his psyche and characteristic? Or would he feel that way if he was as rich as Rancid? That's the question. If he was super rich, would he feel that way? That's the question. And you would say, probably not. But again, maybe, because there's lots of super rich artists that feel bad. Robin Williams, for example, you know.
Yeah. He does strike me as the kind of person that could be super rich from music and still feel that way. Don't you think?
Yes. And it's a shame. I hope he enjoys the success that he has. And I think he probably, I mean, you know, people aren't linear. Sometimes you feel good and sometimes you feel bad. And that's life. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is I definitely want to do a profile of Jesse where I crack the onion open, which definitely won't, but I'll feel like I did. You know what I mean? So anyway, I'm looking forward to this new stuff, man. I hope it's hardcore or punk. I think I would feel, I mean, I'll probably like it no matter what. But if it's like folk or indie rock, which I don't think it would be, or even like post-punk, like Classic of Love, the hardcore band, is so good. I just want them to keep doing that. It's so good.
Yeah.
What if you did a ska band? How would that happen?
I was gonna throw that guess out there, but
I don't see. I think he feels the most ska is pretty cheesy. I would not expect that, frankly.
Yeah, I that's why I didn't throw it out there, because I thought it and then I was like, no, I don't think he would actually do that. I think he would view that as cheesy. Yeah.
Oh man, I just had a bad thought. I hope he doesn't do like melodic punk. Like you know what I mean? Oh my God. I'm no. like, no, Jesse, no. Anyways, let's just do a quick story and then we'll play a track. So Hallie, think of a track you want to play while I do the story. Jive Bomb have released a video for their song Dits. It is off their EP Primitive Desires. And Hallie, I mean, we've had this discussion in other forums before. Tell me if this is an okay thing to say or not okay thing to say. Frankly, a lot of hardcore is boring. A lot of hardcore is four guys in black on blah, blah, the system's crushing me, you know, or I'm depressed, blah, you know. We've got a lot of hardcore bands right now that have female or non-male singers that are doing really interesting music. Scow, which I love. Gel, Jive Bomb. And like, Surfboard isn't hardcore, but it's a punk band with a unique female singer. Is it cool to say that women and non-men are causing a hardcore renaissance right now, or is that, or are we beyond that discussion? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I do find that like when we cover hardcore stuff for the podcast, I just am more interested in the stuff that women are doing. And I was literally just asking myself like why that is today, getting like listening to stuff for this episode, because I was liking the Jive Bomb stuff, and I was thinking to myself, if there were a dude singing this exact same song, would I be as into it? And I like wasn't sure. So I don't that's not at all an answer to your question, just like a random thing that I was thinking before the episode. But I do just think there is something really interesting about what women in hardcore are doing right now. And I don't know what to say. Tell me what you think.
I have a hypothesis. I love the Coat Hangers, and I was thinking, why do I? I mean, the Coat Hangers aren't hardcore. They're punk or even indie, or they're punk. And I'm thinking, why do I love the Coat Hangers so much? Why do I love the Coat Hangers so much? And I realized it's because the things they sing about are different than what. Tend to be different than what all guy bands sing about. And I'm getting a perspective that I haven't heard before. One of the things I love about Coat Hangers, sometimes they sing about politics, which guys do too, you know. But then sometimes they'll sing about their interpersonal relationships with other women, either because of the societal or genetic or whatever constructs. Guy friendship and women friendships probably generally have some distinctions between them overall, you see. And so I'm getting a different perspective that I haven't heard before. I'm hearing about the woman's perspective when she breaks up with a guy or whatever. You know, usually it's you bitch, or the emo guy. I'm so sad. You were my everything. I'm getting a different perspective. So what I love about the Coat Hangers is I feel as though Julia Kugel is talking to me, not as a artifact or as a novelty, but just as a person. And this person has a different perspective than I've heard before in this kind of music. Scow is another great example. Scow's got this song, Don't Look at Me or Don't Touch Me, which there's no song by a guy saying, Don't touch me. You know what I mean? But yeah. Cat Moss is singing it. I'm like, oh, I see Cat Moss's perspective. Or, and also, like, she's got a song about how much it sucks to work in retail. I don't think a guy has ever sung that lyric. You know what I mean? Or but then again, maybe I'm being unfair. Maybe it doesn't matter that she's a woman singing about working in retail. Maybe it's more interesting that she's a person that's singing about working in retail when no other person has sung about, you know, working in retail. But on the other hand, And if I'm saying something uncool, then listeners, let me know. Is a big part of their of Scout, like, she dresses very, quote, girly. So that's a part of the art, you know. You see this very girly looking girl on stage, and then she just sings out like the most, you know, brain busting, skull cracking music, and then you're like, wow, I've got a disconnect, a dissonance here. Society has conditioned me not to expect this kind of music from this a person that looks like that. So it's interesting to see that. This disconnect or journey or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sort of defying your expectations and also turning, I think there is a thing where, like, when women are dressing in a way, I don't know, that our people are going to see as alluring, there's something extra defiant about being dressed in that way. And then your message is like, none of this is for you. The way I dress, the way I sing, the things I say, none of them are for you. This is all for me. There's something just like really powerfully feminist about that, you know, and that, I think also maybe part of it for me is just like when I hear hardcore sometimes now and it's like a male vocalist, there's just a piece of my brain that's like, oh, I feel like I've heard this before. You know, there is just something really interesting about just hearing a woman's voice. It's like sometimes just that can be enough to just kind of crack it open a little bit more for me, just make me a little bit more feel like, oh, I haven't heard exactly this before. So let me like listen up and pay attention to what are the things about this that are new or innovative. I've really been enjoying a lot of the female hardcore that's been coming out.
Let me throw out two more minor points and then we'll play a track. Is consider this also general, Hallie, I think you'll agree in that in general society it's more acceptable for a woman to wear bright flashy clothes than a man, historically speaking. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would. Well,
let me put it this way. Like in court, if you're a guy, you got to wear a suit and you can wear a tie. A woman can wear a red business suit or a black business suit or a white business suit. She's got more color options.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I don't know. I would have to think about this more. To really think about what's my theory on it.
Well, this is just conjecture. I'm not saying I'm putting my foot down. This is my opinion. This is conjecture. I love a great visual show. The cool thing about a lot of the female and non-male performers is they dress very flashy. Now, a guy could dress flashy too, but for whatever reason in hardcore, guys either wear all black or they wear, you know, the tough guy t-shirt and jeans, you know what I mean? Whereas visually, we've got someone wearing something aside from these other two options. You know, like, I love surfboard. I love surfboard on stage. Danny Miller wears all these really cool David Bowie-esque clothes, you know what I mean? Or yeah. Kat Moss dresses like Great Gatsby or something, you know what I mean? So it's cool to see someone dressing differently on stage. It's just a different, you know, it's just a step away from the same old, same old. You know.
Yeah, well, it's like women are all, they're like, I already can't fit your mold of what you think a hardcore singer should look like. So why should I try to match the rest of your definition of what a hardcore singer is wearing this particular uniform? Or go ahead.
Sorry. Or how about like Amy Taylor, like wearing a bikini top and shorts or like a cat suit or something of Amy on the Sniffers? You know, that's visually more interesting than some dude in a T-shirt that I've seen so many times before.
I mean, I would love to see guys in hardcore like break out of that, you know, whether it's lyrics or outfit or anything. I would love to see, go ahead.
I will give you a remedy for that. Lotion, which isn't strictly hardcore. Alexander Hare, he wears like Terminator 2 clothes or just like doctor's outfits. That's why I love Lotion. You know, Lotion is so awesome. Far out there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
One other thing, and then we'll wrap this up, though. Simultaneously, interestingly, we are definitely seeing a rise in the popularity of regressive hardcore bands. Bands that are not only embracing cliche, but are like saluting cliche. Like there's this band, Speed, that everyone loves. And it's like, oh my God, like, you know, we're in a gang and we're going to beat you up. We're Speed. It's like, oh my God. It's like, this was born in 1988 when Floor Punch was doing it, and you're doing it now and people are loving it. And there's a whole bunch of other bands that do exactly that. And I'm not going to name them because it's going to bum some people out, but there's so many just like generic faux tough guy hardcore bands that everyone is like saluting now and saying is great, when it's like you are reveling in cliche and you are reveling, you are taking comedic cliche and treating it as though it's serious, but not in a comedic manner. And I'm like, I don't know why that's happening right now. I guess bell bottoms come and go every 30 years. So I guess that's where we're at with hardcore, you know?
Well, it's like you're saying, it's also like for young people, it's like, you know, they didn't get to see all the generations of bands that were doing this before. Like, this is what they have access to, you know? So, and they're having their mind blown by it in the same way that you were talking about, you know?
Well said. Hallie Bull played track, and we're already, Hallie Bull and I were saying, well, we don't have that much to talk about. We're already running long.
I know. We do shoot the shit, John Gentile.
We do. We'll play track, Hallie, and we'll come back. Go ahead.
Well, it's a little bit of a spoiler, but I do like this. I did enjoy the Iggy Pop track that we're going to talk about later. So why don't we play that so people have a frame of reference? They know what the hell we're talking about. It's Iggy Pop doing Strung Out Johnny.
Time to pay. First time you do it with a friend. Second time you do it in bed. Third time you can't get it on. Then you let yourself go.
And we are back in the Iggy Pop doing Strung Out Johnny. Hallie Bullet, tell us about Strung Out Johnny. Strung Out Johnny's off his upcoming album, which is going to be out next week, which I feel it's called Every Loser. I feel like an Iggy Pop album. Like, I remember when Iggy Pop released that album with Josh Homme, it was like a huge deal. But I feel like this album is not getting a whole lot of power behind it. I feel like it's going to kind of come out. But Hallie Bullet, Strung Out, did you? Apparently you did dig it. Why did you dig it? And are you excited for the new Iggy Pop album? And does Iggy Pop have one or more great albums left in them?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't that excited about it until I heard the song. And then I don't know. It just was interesting to me. It wasn't exactly what I was expecting. It just sounded... I don't know. I just still think there's just something so, this is something so captivating about him, you know? And this song sounded to me just more relevant than any guy his age has a right to be putting out. I liked it. I didn't like love it. I'm not going to listen to it like a million times, but I did think there was something interesting there. I just think I just feel that he still puts thought into things. It still feels like a statement when he puts music out. It may not always be the statement that you're like wanting to hear, but I think he's cool. I like it. I guess that's not a revolutionary thing to say. Iggy Pop is cool. did you like the track?
I like the track. I think it's one of the better later day Iggy albums. One of the frustrating things about Iggy, and everyone's scared to say it, is a lot of his solo albums are just boring, you know, and it's like I feel like this was recorded in a weekend, whereas, you know, the first three Stooges album and the first two Iggy solo albums are like all mind-blowingly good. And I think what it comes down to is the musician that he recorded with for a lot of his career, they just didn't have the goods, you know? He even recorded with Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols, but it's not Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols. It's some guy named Steve Jones who wasn't the Sex Pistols, but he's not playing like Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols. He's just kind of doing generic 80s rock, not the thundering crack of the Sex Pistols, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like, well... I guess what it is the Stooges was not a democracy, but it wasn't a dictatorship. It was a brawl. And that's, you know, everyone, not everyone, but like the main guys each got their say and they had to fight it out. With the Iggy Pop first two albums, Iggy had the benefit of having David Bowie kind of direct the scene, which to no surprise, those are great albums.
Yeah.
But I think once Iggy's in command, either he doesn't care enough or he doesn't have the musical knowledge to say, like, as great of a performance singer as Iggy is, he needs the killer band behind him. Some guys don't need a killer band behind him. I'm not a Nick Cave fan. I'm not a hater, but I'm not a Nick Cave fan. But you put Nick Cave in front of anything, it's still going to be Nick Cave. Iggy needs the thunder or the cold chill like the Idiot album.
Mm-hmm.
This track right here kind of does have the cold chill, which is neat. I wish that he would do at least one last album where it is the Iggy Pop berserk animal. And I get that he's almost 80, but I still, I mean, he can do it because live he still is amazing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, as self-assured and as confident as Iggy is, I wonder if he does have some self-confidence issues in that, like, in all of his recordings post 88, 1990, he presents himself as this, you know, erudite, scholarly, educated, worldly guy, which he is. You know, he did those two albums where he's singing in French, or even on like on the last two, the new Stooges albums, he's like quoting, you know, Proust, you know, or Camus.
Yeah.
And that's cool, but I also love Iggy the crazy animal that I can't fathom at how berserk he is, you know? And I think maybe it might be he knows that he's not that person anymore, or it might be that he doesn't want to be treated as just a kind of a dumb mug, which the Stooges were treated when they were first around the first time, you know, where, you know, of course, Iggy's an extremely intelligent guy. But I mean, if you ask me, as cool as the cool, measured, control, cosmic Iggy is, my favorite Iggy is the berserk animal. And he does it live. I just wish he would do it on record at least one more time with a band that can hold their own. And I think I'm definitely not a Josh Homme fan at all. Not a fan at all. But I did think, well, maybe this band does have the firepower. But they did the David Bowie thing, which was kind of cool and collected, you know. Whereas I wish if he would just go with like a berserk band, like the Coat Hangers or the Mean Jeans, you know, I think he really could do one last, you know, the Passenger type destroyer album, you know.
I think like when it comes to the music he makes, that that just doesn't feel like the person that he is. Like I wonder, but I agree with you that like live he just still like he really just does light shit on fire. I wonder if it's just like, does playing those old songs like help him tap into some, you know, younger piece of himself, or like he's been performing those songs so aggressively for so long that he can't not go apeshit when he plays them. But I could see where just when it comes to the music that he's sitting down and writing and recording, I could see maybe just, you know, you're like, that's who I was. I'm not that person anymore.
Well, fake it, Iggy. If Jesse Michaels, here's what he should do. He needs to link up with Jesse Michaels, tell the Hard Girls to stop doing, you know, kind of quiet, self-reflective post-punk, even though they're not even a band anymore. Kick out the hardcore. Iggy, Jesse, and the Hard Girls, best album 2023. That's what I'm saying. on the side of West Coast band, even though Psychics were not West Coast band, they toured West Coast a lot, and I see them out on the West Coast all the time with Classics of Love, with Jeff Rosenstock, with the kind of the Asian Man band. I don't know if Psychics ever did a record on Asian Man Records, but they were associated with the Asian Man Records. The Psychics have broken up. A lot of the listeners might not even know, like back in the day in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, the Sidekicks were like one of like the big punk news bands. Like people, they might even got almost like album of the year, 1 year of punk news. Like the Sidekicks were huge at punk news and people love them. And I was surprised they were still a band. They actually put out an album in 2018 on Epitaph, which wasn't that long ago. I didn't even know they were still a band, but they broke up. And it kind of, people said, oh yeah, the Sidekicks, man, I love that band, but it wasn't like some big explosive thing. It was kind of like the Sidekicks are no more. And people were like, I used to love that band. Hallie, are you sad? Were you surprised? What's your stance on the Sidekicks and their end?
Yeah, I mean, I've known those guys a long time. They used to put some stuff out on Whoa Records when the Unlovables were still on Whoa Records. I actually think it's interesting that we're talking about them in this episode when we've talked a lot about like, well, I'll just say this. I think the thing that I think is cool about the Sidekicks is that they were making music for so long. And I think they actually significantly changed their sound. They kind of even changed, I think, a lot like the people that were into them and were fans of them. But they kept the name of Sidekicks, and it was always those guys. And I always admired them for that. I thought there was something really cool about that. A lot of people, if they wanted to change their sound or do something slightly different, or just it's been a certain number of years that they've been doing a project and they feel like maybe they want to generate new interest in what they're doing, they'll start a new band or start a new project. I thought there was something so cool about that. These guys just liked playing music together, and they wanted to keep doing it this long. I think it's cool. I think they're cool guys. And I like you though. Like when I read this announcement, there was a piece of me that was like, oh wait, were the Sidekicks still together? But like they hadn't released anything in what, almost like 5 years or something, right?
Yeah.
But so I guess there's something that's sad about them actually just like officially calling it quits. And they announced that they all have like, you know, new projects going on. So I guess they finally felt like it was time to move on. But I think it's cool that they, I don't know, this thing, this project, this band name, it still meant something to them, and they were still motivated to keep working on this same thing for so long. It's like so many other bands there are people that have like started and quit six bands in the time that the Sidekicks were just one band. So I think it's kind of admirable.
It's got to be a weird feeling to like disband a band that you're disbanding because you can disband it. And that like a lot of bands can't disband because they make too much money, you know, and a lot of bands can disband because no one gives a shit at all. The Sidekicks are like kind of in the middle in that like they're probably not supporting themselves with the Sidekicks. They've already put like 15 years into this band. It's got to be a real mixed feeling. It's like the adventure's over, you know. That's got to be scary. Probably somewhat of a relief and probably a really weird feeling, you know, probably some regret, but also probably some vindication, you know?
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah, man. You know, being a band is weird. Tough. Here's a band that's disbanding by their own choice. I don't know if we're gonna actually. Is this the last story of the day? This might be the last story of the day. Mm-hmm. This is the last story of the day. NoFX is disbanding, which we all knew. And I did an interview with Fat Mike, which I'm probably going to try to run next week. It's going to be a pretty in-depth interview and should answer a lot of questions. But what NoFX is doing is they are playing full albums on their final tour. And a lot of people were kind of annoyed because they're like, I don't want to hear a full album. I want to hear a greatest hit set. I think Fat Mike's perspective is that, like, they want to make the final tour something special, not just another tour. So Hallie Bullet, what do you think of them doing full albums on their final tour? And what do you think of NoFX disbanding? Were you as caught off guard as pretty much everyone else was?
I was kind of caught off guard because it just seemed like they would just play until they died, you know? Yeah. I have not been super interested in them as a band in a long time. And so I did make myself chuckle when I read this story and I read the albums that they were going to be doing in full. And I just did feel myself like I felt some old fan in me stirring, being like, oh man, I really want to see that. It was just funny to feel that after so long of just, certainly not disliking them or not, you know, just sort of having pretty much just feeling totally neutral about them and their existence. But I think these shows are going to be really fun. I think the people at them are going to have a good time. Again, you know, talking about people that have been problematic, I just don't know that I can get the same enjoyment out of NoFX as I used to. But for the people that can and are going, I don't know. I guess I hope it's a fun time.
You know something? I don't know. Like, NoFX is problematic. I mean, is there like one big firecracker thing you know, or just their general existence over the years and the pranks they've done, such as clashing with Kathy and Hannah and the punk rock bowling thing? Like, do you have something explosive aside from that?
I mean, I just, I think he's said like some pretty anti-Muslim stuff at shows, which is deeply offensive to me. And I also, yeah, I was just one of those people that, like, I really didn't find the Las Vegas comment acceptable at all. I didn't think it was fucking punk rock or that there was anything funny about it. I just thought it was totally asinine. So, you know, I don't get the same. Yeah, I don't feel that I like him as a person the way that I did when I was like a huge, huge fan. It's not why I stopped listening to them. I stopped listening to theirs because they're, you know, years prior, because their music stopped being as interesting to me. But, you know, I don't know. He's done enough great things that I have to believe him to be like, I don't know. What's the deal with Fat Mike, man? You interviewed him. What's his fucking deal, man? He's over the map, this guy.
I think I kind of know the deal. Let me put it this way. I've got the unique position of never being a NoFX fan, but never being a hater either. Yeah. I enjoy Fat Mike, the artistic statement, in that really here's Fat Mike in a nutshell. Fat Mike comes from the first or second wave of punk rock, 1982. Most punks out there today come from just after that or even later. What has been lost due to bands like Bad Religion is that, like, the sense of fun, whimsy, and pranksterism in punk rock. Punk as a whole is pretty much now the discord, crass Bad Religion view, in that it's a political thing about doing what's right morally, you know, which is cool. I love crass. It's one of my very favorite bands. But Fat Mike doesn't necessarily come from that school. You know, punk wasn't always just that. You know, punk, from some perspective, you know, the Circle Jerks, they had a political bend too, but there's something like just causing mischief for the sake of causing mischief, offending mm-hmm. the audience just to offend the audience. Like, the bands like the Screamers, bands like the Germs, bands like Black Rain and the Metro Squad, any of the subtitles. The point of some of those bands was just to F with the audience, especially Black Randy, you know. And so Fat Mike comes from that, and he's, throughout his career, he's tried to maintain that sense of mischief, chaos, and fun, all while being one of the bigger punk rock bands there is, and carving out his own niche, which I feel that he's done. I'm not saying that I think NoFX is the best band ever, because, like I said, I'm lukewarm on the band as a whole. But I do enjoy Fat Mike the character, and I'm not going to blow it now. Hal, if you want to talk afterwards, I can tell you pretty much who I think Fat Mike is, and I'm pretty sure I'm right. But that being said, he's an interesting guy. With the Las Vegas thing, I think it was not cool that he said what he said, but I don't think it's that big of a deal. He said something crazy on stage. Lots of comedians say crazy stuff on stage, and I don't think it was that big of a deal. I think a slap on the wrist would have been good enough, but everyone's entitled to their own opinion, and some people think he should have got beat more, and some people think he should have got beat less. I don't know him personally. I've interviewed him a bunch of times, and he's always been cool to me, but I mean, I'm not going to say, like, if someone has a beef with him, I'm not going to step in and say you're wrong like I would with some other artists, because I don't know him that well. But I will say I think one of the greatest compliments I can give to NoFX is that they kind of remained interesting from an artistic standpoint and a pranksterism standpoint, and doing something other people haven't done, all while commenting on punk itself. Like their album, Single Album and Double Album, which is a single album, that's kind of a funny commentary on punk rock, which I dig, you know.
Well, I know, yeah, but were any of the songs on that good?
No, but that's, well, to me,
that's... he can say a clever thing. Like, he can say, like, he can make a clever title, but, like, I don't know. If, like, none of the songs on the record are good, then, like, how interesting are they, or how much are they pushing the envelope? You know what I'm saying?
But then, if I could counter, the Cokie the Clown concept, I thought, was genius. Not genius, but extremely, extremely good. People were freaked out by Cokie the Clown. And
okay, I'm sorry. I know I like host a music podcast, and I'm supposed to know this, but I literally don't know what you're talking about. Oh, I really, really stopped caring about this band or paying attention. I'm sorry.
Well, I'll talk about Cokie the Clown, then we'll wrap this one up. So okay. It must have been about 10 years ago now. Fat Mike adopted this persona, Cokie the Clown, and he would do solo shows, and he would come on stage dressed as a very sad clown, and then he would tell these incredibly depressing stories, like how the time he had to kill his mom, literally, or like just the worst of the worst stories. Then the grand finale of Cokie the Clown was, I think it was South by Southwest. He came out on stage, and then he handed out he had a tray of shots of, like, whiskey or what's the one with the deer on it? Jägermeister? I think it was, yeah. Jägermeister. Yeah, Jägermeister. So we handed out shots of Jägermeister to people, and people, like, took shots of Jägermeister. He did his set, and he had a VHS with him, and he took the VHS and he put in a TV on stage, and he walked off stage, and the TV played, and it showed him peeing into the bottle of Jägermeister before pouring it into the shots and then giving it to people on stage, which is
gross.
However, about 5 or 6 years later, he proved that, honestly, you could get sued for that, honestly, you know?
Yeah.
He showed that it was actually a fake out. He bought a fake wiener and filled that with Jägermeister and peed that into the thing, you know what I mean? Yeah. But to me, like, I would be mad if it was me, but as far as destructive, challenging, very punk rock art, I would say that's among the most interesting that's been done in the 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see it, but it sounds like he was definitely trying to do something that was going to challenge people. And you're right, that is at the heart of what a lot of punk is.
And here's what it comes down to. Hallie knows that I love the punk bands that are self-destructive. I'm on drugs. I hate the world. I want to die. You know, like Surfboard, like the Circle Jerks, like all these bands. Like, I hate the world. Whereas most punk rockers, like, we're in a club and we're going to do the right thing together, which is equally valid. And it all comes down to that divide, frankly. And that's punk rock, if you ask me. You know, Hallie Bull, any last words for the listeners this week?
No. I don't have any. I'm all talked out. We've really talked a lot.
We really have. Well, when it gets a duo style, that's what it's like. Let's play, I don't know. You want to play Gizem or how about Jive Bomb? Should we play Jive Bomb?
Sure.
Let's play some Jive Bomb. This is Jive Bomb. And we will see you
later.
This is a new one off the EP. We just put out Primitive Design. It's a dancey one. So I like to dance like a fool. Go for it.